From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's show, we're going to take a look at press freedom in a couple of countries in Africa with completely different climates for the media. In a few minutes, we're going to talk about the West African nation of Ghana, which has a reputation for being one of the most free and vibrant media environments, not just in Africa, but the world. That's why the recent murder of a senior journalist at one of the country's premier investigative news outlets has caused a huge public outcry. But first, we're going to turn our attention to Egypt. Egypt is a key ally of the U.S. in the Middle East, but it's also one of the most restrictive countries in the world for journalists. Back in 2011, during the Arab Spring, it looked like Egypt would have quite a different future. But after a brief opening following the ouster of longtime President Hosni Mubarak, Egypt has become much more repressive again under the current president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. As of last December, it had 25 journalists in jail. That's the most of any country in the world, save for Turkey and China, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. To talk about Egypt, we're joined by a couple of guests who have been following the country closely. With us from Brisbane, Australia, is Peter Grest. He's a longtime international correspondent who was jailed for more than a year in Egypt while he was working for Al Jazeera. Grest is also the author of the 2017 book, The First Casualty, a memoir from the front lines of the war on journalism. He's now a journalism professor at Queensland University in Australia. Peter, welcome.
Thanks very much.
With us in New York, we're pleased to welcome back to the program Sharif Mansour. He's an Egyptian-American human rights researcher and activist who himself has spent some time in Egyptian custody. He's now the Middle East Program Coordinator at the Committee to Protect Journalists. Sharif, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Sharif, let me start with you. Give us just a snapshot of what the situation is now for independent journalists in Egypt.
Well, this is the worst time in recent memory to be a journalist for many reasons. It's not just Egypt was third worst jailer of journalists last year. It has been consistently so for the last 5 years since President Sisi took over. And even every dash of reform hopes that has been hoped for him by re-electing himself last year to open up the space have gone. On the contrary, we saw the largest kind of detention wave under this kind of false news justification that, in addition to that, 25 people who have seen in jail in December have brought into circulation at the tens more over the course of the year would be detained, put in a horrible position before they let go. Then the government at the end of the year passed a package of legislation that criminalized a lot of legitimate forms of journalism, including online journalism, and requiring licenses and justifying blocking of websites for the first time in Egypt's history.
One of the things that you mentioned is prosecutions of journalists for fake news. But I want to turn this to Peter Greste, because you spent more than a year in an Egyptian prison for your role as a reporter in the country. Just remind our listeners briefly why you were arrested back in late 2013 and why it was you ended up spending more than a year in jail.
It was 400 days, in fact. We were working in Egypt covering the unfolding political crisis at the time. There was still a lot of protests in the street. A lot of supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood were out there, and we were doing what any responsible journalist would do.
And sorry, just to back you up, so this is about 6 months after the coup that toppled Mohamed Morsi, sort of the Muslim Brotherhood, pro-Muslim Brotherhood president of Egypt, who took over sort of after the Arab Spring. He was elected after the Arab Spring, so el-Sisi and the military had just taken control.
Well, the military had taken control. There was an interim government in place at the time. President Sisi wasn't elected then. He was still a military commander. And what we saw was, as you rightly said, a lot of supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood who were demanding the restoration of the government. And this is a really important point, because although the government, the interim government, had started accusing the Muslim Brotherhood of being involved in acts of terrorism, you've got to remember that the Brotherhood had formed the first democratically elected government in Egypt's history before it was ousted. So in any classic definition of democracy, it counted as the opposition. And so we felt we had a duty to speak to the Brotherhood and its supporters. We were arrested and we were charged with terrorism offences. being members of a terrorist organization, aiding and abetting a terrorist organization, financing a terrorist organization, and crucially, broadcasting false news with intent to undermine national security. They were all pretty serious charges. And after a trial that lasted about 6 months, we were convicted and sentenced to between 7 and 10 years.
Well, Sharif Mansour, we mentioned that there are something like 24 journalists in jail in Egypt right now. You said that this is something that has been going on for several years. There was the release recently of a fairly high-profile photojournalist named Mahmoud Abu Zayd. He's better known as Shao Kahn. Tell us about his arrest and legal troubles.
Well, it all comes back to 2013. He was one of the earliest journalists to be arrested. And to Peter's point, in 2012, there were no journalists behind bars in Egypt for the first time in a long, long time. That was one of the biggest wins of the Arab Spring, that we could see the country free of journalists behind bars. But that has quickly shifted, and Shao Kahn was one of the witnesses, not just on that day, that massacre, that saw 4 journalists killed.
And so he was arrested during this big protest in Cairo by supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood. He was there as a photojournalist covering it. It sounds like what happened is the security forces came to break up the protest and ended up actually killing many, many, many people and arresting lots of others, including Shao Kahn.
And he coming out, he will see a different Egypt that he saw when he went into jail 5 years ago, where no one dares take the camera around as well. That was one of the things that he, as a photojournalist, could feel safe in 2012 and 2013 doing in Egypt. Now he can do. No one can cover protests the same way people used to do during the Arab Spring. Shao Kahn, to this day, is still not free, even after he served 5 years on no crime other than taking his journalist, his camera to do work. He is still being punished to have to do this probation every day, spend the night, and sometimes, as had happened 2 days ago, he was kept in custody again.
So he's been released from jail, but he has to report to a police station every day at 6 p.m. and then spend the night sleeping at a police station so he can be monitored, and then he's sort of free to walk around during the daytime.
Exactly, and he's deprived of a lot of his financial rights also. Even his chance of relief, like Peter has had when he was released, to be able to be treated, to have a medical and psychological rest after going through a very, very tough time. He was 27 when he was arrested. When you look at him now, released, you look, he's gained 10 or more years of age while in custody.
Well, Peter, you spent 400 days inside Egyptian prisons. When you were brought to court, there are these sort of haunting images of you being kept in a cage. I mean, tell us just a bit about what some of these Egyptian journalists may be experiencing in prison.
Well, I wouldn't recommend it to anybody. Pretty horrific conditions, although it does vary quite a lot. Most of the prisoners are held within the Torah complex, which is a fairly large complex of separate prisons. I was kept in 2 police cells and 3 separate prisons. But the conditions, wherever you are pretty horrific. Typically, most people are in chronically overcrowded spaces. One of the cells that I was in was about 8 foot square, and I reckon, about 8 foot square. And there were 16 guys in that cell. There was barely enough room. It was impossible to lie down. When you had to sleep, everyone was lying on top of one another. There is nutrition, there was food, but it was very, very basic. There was a culture of families bringing food into the inmates. And so if you didn't have supporters, family outside of supporters, or if you weren't, or your family wasn't able to get to the prison, then you were in very serious danger of starving or malnutrition. Rat-infested, cockroach-infested cells, quite typically. Some really, really difficult conditions.
And you mentioned that actually before the show that one of the people that was your cellmates there is still in prison, a blogger.
That's right, Allah Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Allah Abdel Fattah, one of the most remarkable figures I've ever met, an incredibly intelligent character. who I think was one of the main inspirations for the January 25th revolution. He was one of the guys that was most prominent in that period, and I think that's also why he's still in prison. He has been again charged with terrorism offences, and I think this is really key here, that most of the people that have been imprisoned, as far as the Egyptians are concerned, there are no journalists in prison, they've only got terrorists. And it's, I think, what's really troubling, and what we see out of Egypt, and what's important for the rest of the world to see, is the way that the Egyptians have used national security as an excuse to target bloggers, target journalists, target anyone who's speaking out. That conflation of freedom of speech with national security is a key point, because it's happening in the most extreme way in Egypt, but it's not unique to Egypt. We're seeing this typically play out all over the world.
Well, Peter, I want to come back to this point, but first, Sharif Mansour, if I could ask you about the role of the United States in Egyptian politics. The U.S. is a key ally of Egypt. It provides Egypt with a lot of foreign aid. It sells Egypt a lot of military hardware here. What has the U.S. said and done about this sort of situation, not just with regards to press freedom, but really the complete erosion of any sort of democratic governance in Egypt?
In our analysis of the prison data last year, we mentioned that not just Egypt, Turkey and other U.S. allies have paid scant price for jailing journalists, and as it became a norm now internationally to have more than 250 journalists behind bars every year, thankfully and largely because of two or three countries, including Egypt. And we think that not just that political cover that was provided in terms of the rhetoric that resulted in Egypt becoming last year the worst in terms of using the charge of fake news. The world leader of charging journalists was fake news was 19 journalists out of 28 worldwide. That is connected to what the Egyptian government think is justifiable to say until they can prove it by law at the end of the year by passing this parliament, passing legislation that for the first time say that anyone with 5,000 followers on social media is liable for anything they say under national security, terrorism, and fake news charges.
Well, Sharif Mansour, Peter Greste, we're out of time for this section of Global Journalist. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you for having me.
A reminder that you're tuned into Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. A quick reminder that you can check us out online at globaljournalist.org. You can find our archives and additional coverage of underreported international news and human rights issues. Now, on today's program, we're talking about press freedom issues. In a couple of African countries, we just heard about the repressive climate for reporters in Egypt. Up next, we're going to move to the West African nation of Ghana. Now, Ghana has been a beacon of democracy and freedom in Africa for some time, but the nation was rocked by the murder of an investigative journalist named Ahmed Hussein Swale back in January. Ahmed had worked for a well-known investigative group called Tiger Eye Private Investigations. It was known for doing undercover exposés of corruption. Last year, he led a team that uncovered widespread bribery of dozens of soccer officials and referees in the country. And this report led Ghana's top soccer league to cancel its entire season. So to tell us more about Ahmed's life and death, we're joined by two guests who have been following his story closely. With us in Dakar, Senegal, is Hassan Diagne. He's the West Africa Office Director for the press freedom group Reporters Without Borders. Hassan, welcome.
Thank you.
And with us in London is Joel Gunter. He's a journalist with BBC News who wrote a very detailed story about Ahmed's killing called Murder in Accra, The Life and Death of Ahmed Hussein Swale. Joel, welcome.
Thank you.
Hassan, if you could just talk to us about this investigation into bribery and match fixing in Ghanaian soccer. What were some of the reactions to this investigation that Ahmed had worked on? I believe it was published in June.
Okay. As far as the investigation itself is concerned, I can say that the investigation has stalled. There's no significant progress so far. Some initial arrests were made and some people were questioned, but they were released on police inquiry bail pending further investigation. That's the what we got from the police communication director, Mr. David Senanu Eklu.
Okay, so this is with respect to the investigation of Ahmed's death then, is that basically it doesn't sound like there has been a lot of progress and police officials aren't saying much. But Joel Gunter, if I could bring you in, talk to us just a little bit about this investigative firm called Tiger Eye. What sorts of reports do they do? Tell us a little bit about this investigation into Ghanaian soccer.
Yeah, so as you said at the top of the program, Ahmed worked for Tiger Eye, which is an investigative reporting outfit based in Ghana, led by Anas Arameor Anas, who is well known across the country, and in part because of his very particular disguise that he wears, a mask that covers his face. These guys work in near total secrecy to preserve their ability to do undercover reporting, and that included Ahmed. So, for an example, when they were working on the number 12 investigation, which was the soccer investigation you talked about, he set up a meeting between a high-profile African FIFA official and a sort of fake sheikh in the Middle East. And Ahmed was a very quiet, unassuming guy who established this meeting. That was the kind of work they did.
Okay, and so they actually taped, I believe it was the head of the Ghanaian Soccer Association, taking a bag of $65,000 in cash. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. Kwesi Nantachi, and he was not only the head of the Ghanaian Soccer Association, he was also a member of FIFA's elite council. So this is a really important member of African football. That number 12 investigation began by catching out Ghanaian referees who were taking bribes, but broadened outside of Ghana to other countries in West Africa and eventually to Kwesi Nantachi, who flew to the Middle East for a meeting with what he thought was a sheikh, but was actually a man who was working for Tiger Eye. I had a meeting with him at which Ahmed was present and took $65,000 in cash in a black plastic bag.
Okay, so these are like hidden camera stings then is what they do. But Hassan Dian, if I could turn this back to you then, what do we know about Ahmed Hussein Swale's death? I understand that he was shot and killed. Is it clear that this wasn't like a robbery or just sort of ordinary street crime? Talk to us about how he was killed.
What we know about Ahmed Hussein Osale and the investigation, that it's very, very, very difficult to get information from the police. When you talk to Ghanaian journalists, they all complained about the lack of transparency of the investigation and explained how hard it is to get information from the police in charge of this case. So that's why here at Reporters Without Borders, we keep on asking for transparency into this investigation and openness to open the sources to the journalists so that people can know who are behind this killing and to punish them.
And Hassan, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I mean, this is actually quite surprising in a way that this happened in a place like Ghana. It's known as a free place. The press there is very lively. There's lots of criticism of the president, of the government.
Yeah, for Reporters Without Borders, killing a journalist for his work is extremely abnormal, mainly when it happens in Ghana, which is ranked 23rd out of 180 countries in our last ranking of world freedom in the world. It's Africa's highest ranking, so that's why it's a particular concern for Reporters Without Borders.
Well, Joel, you interviewed people, I guess, in the neighborhood of Accra where Ahmed Hussein Swale was killed. What did they tell you about the night he was murdered?
So in terms of the night of the shooting itself, he was with his family members in Medina, the Accra suburb where they lived. He left close to midnight to go and help a nephew who he looked after. And he got in his car and drove a very short distance down the road before two men who had a motorbike fired at him at point blank range through his car window. It was, by all accounts, from the eyewitnesses that I spoke to, an execution style killing. And in fact, neighbors who live in the area told us that they had seen the two men hanging around in the area on a couple of occasions before the night that he died. And they very much got the impression that they were sort of scoping the area out, waiting for something. And obviously what happened on that night suggests that they were there waiting around for Ahmed. And on the day that he did go and visit his family, they killed him.
And it doesn't appear that this was a robbery because his wallet wasn't taken, nothing was missing from his car.
I mean, with the situation with the police investigation at the moment, we can't go on television and say definitively this was an assassination, but there is absolutely no suggestion that there could be any other motive here. There was no robbery. There was no attempt to rob him. He was killed in what can only be described as a sort of execution style killing. And the fact that we had these eyewitnesses reports that these men were there on a number of occasions, strangers in the neighborhood, appearing to be waiting for someone. A police source on the investigation told me during my reporting that while they couldn't say this on the record, you know, there was every indication that this was an assassination style killing.
Well, let me back you up then, if I could, Joel, because actually there had been a Ghanaian member of parliament. I believe his name is Kennedy Agyapong he's actually from the majority, the ruling party, the New Patriotic Party in Ghana. He did not like this expose about corruption in Ghanaian soccer that Ahmed had worked on. Talk to us about his reaction.
Yeah, I spoke to Kennedy Agyapong in the week after Ahmed was killed. To backtrack, as you mentioned, he went on his own television show, his own television network in Ghana, and published pictures that had been obtained of Ahmed's face because these weren't in the public domain. Like I said before, these guys working for Tiger Eye went to every length to try and keep their identity secret. But he put these pictures on his television network and he named Ahmed and he said that he hung around in the neighborhood of Medina where Ahmed's family lived. And he essentially called on people to commit violence against him.
Yeah, I think you quoted him as saying, if you meet him somewhere, slap him, beat him, whatever happens, I'll pay.
Exactly, whatever happens, I'll pay, he said. I reached out to him after Ahmed died, which was about 6 months after that television broadcast, and he was completely unrepentant. His version of events is that he's simply offended by the methods that Tiger Eye uses in their investigations, their undercover methods, and that he thought the right thing to do was to try and expose them. And when I asked him if he had any regrets about what had happened, he said, I have no regrets at all because they're all evil.
And we should say also that we reached out to Kennedy Agyapong a couple times to speak on this program. He did not respond to those queries. But Asan Dion, if I could bring this back to you, talk to us about what sort of message this sends to other investigative journalists in Ghana. What effect will this have on investigations of this type?
We can mention Reporters Without Borders. We used to mention that what happened in Ghana is the summum of what threats are upon those who are involved in investigative journalism in Africa. They face any kind of threats, a killing, jail, economic pressure, and many other issues like that that can infringe the freedom to inform. So this is really very risky, but as I said earlier, it's a concern because it happens in Ghana, which was usually considered as a model country in terms of freedom of speech, freedom of information in Africa in general.
Well, Joel Gunter, if I could turn this back to you then. We had been talking about this Ghanaian member of parliament, Kennedy Agyapong, who had gone on television and basically directly threatened Ahmed in the months before he was killed. I mean, is it fair to say that he's the prime suspect in this? Is it clear, like, who may have done this? Or is it not, are things not that straightforward?
No, things are certainly not that straightforward, and I certainly don't think we could say that Kennedy Ajapong is the prime suspect. What I did establish when I was reporting that story was that the police had reached out informally both to Mr. Ajapong and to Kwesi Nantachi as well, the member of FIFA Elite Council, and
so
questioned
this,
them.
Sorry, so they reached out to the guy who had been on camera accepting $65,000 from this sort of fake sheikh, as you said, in the Middle East.
That's right. The head of the Ghanaian Soccer Association, who we were talking about earlier, because I mean, obviously, both of them have spoken out against Anas Armeor Anas and Ahmed, who worked with him, about their investigations. And we know that both of them have essentially made some form of threat against the group. Kennedy Ajapong live on television and Kwesi Nantachi privately to Anas Anas. So it's hard to avoid the conclusion that, you know, the police would be considering them in their investigation. We know that we spoke to them. But beyond that, we don't really have any information. They're certainly not the prime suspects in the sense that we know they didn't literally carry out the killing. And we don't know that police have been able to establish yet who, if anybody, was sort of pulling the strings behind the killers.
And of course, this soccer investigation, Joel, is hardly the only one that Ahmed had worked on. I think, as you referenced in your article, Tiger Eye had done a big investigation in the judiciary that led to the resignation of a number of Ghanaian judges. I know they had done an investigation of bribery in the Ghanaian Customs Service, many, many other investigations of this type. So it sounds like there could be a lot of people who headed in for Ahmed.
Yeah, I mean, from the point of view of the police in Ghana, it's a tricky one if they don't have any concrete leads, because certainly you could say that the work that Ahmed was involved in could have garnered him many, many enemies along the way. I mean, you mentioned they did a very high profile investigation into members of the Ghanaian judiciary. There was the police investigation into customs officials and many other perhaps slightly smaller scale investigations, including some they worked on with us at the BBC into sort of ritual killers in Ghana. So if you were starting from the point of view of the police and you had really no concrete leads, they did work that frustrated people. They did good, solid investigative journalism. And sometimes, unfortunately, that makes you enemies.
And Hassan, our time grows short. I'll give the last word to you. Are you optimistic that there will be justice in this case?
Yes, that's my personal opinion. I think that with the pressure of people coming from everywhere in the world and the independence of Ghanaian justice, we hope that there's no significant progress so far, but things may change every time and lead to the arrest and the imprisonment of those who ordered the killing of Ahmed Hussein Swali.
Well, we're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Peter Greste, Sharif Mansour, Hassan Diani, and Joel Gunter. Our assistant producers this week are Samantha Wiegand, Megan Smaltz, Connor O'Halloran, and Gail Fournier. Rosie Belson is supervising producer. Grace Lett is visual editor. Aaron Hay is audio engineer. Travis McMillan is director. Support for this program comes from the Lee Hills Chair in Free Press Studies at the University of Missouri. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.